Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee and welcome members, including Senator Beyer with us today, and
That'll take care of home.
Ed Waters and Bruce Weber, good to have you with us. The unveiling today of the long-awaited, much-anticipated, breathlessly looked forward to Oregon tax incident. Stifle that yawn. Oregon.
Look at the crowd. Look at the crowd. Scared?
They all thought it was going to be SRO, so they stayed in their offices to watch on television.
Mr. Chair, we thought about OTM, the whole shot and start as a title.
Some may be waiting for the movie.
Mr. Chair, Senate Revenue Committee, it's anything but schools.
Go ahead, Paul.
Mr. Chair, I've got a summary packet for you, summary of process, methodology, and initial results. I'd like to walk through with you very quickly to give you the real big overview of this. Ed then will talk about the economic part of OTIM, and then Bruce will go through the distribution results and the work that he's done in that area. So those are the three pieces we have planned for you, but I just wanted to for you to step back for a few minutes and look at the major findings really of OTIM and think about it in terms of how it will fit in the overall in your tax policy analysis toolkit. We do also have an amended rules for the committee, too, that would involve the use of OTIM.
We will take that up after the presentation.
I think you'll find that OTIM will be a very valuable tool, in my view, and being pretty familiar with the capability of most other states. I think this tool is state-of-the-art, certainly for a state our size. But it does have limitations, and we will continually remind you of that. It is limited by what the state of the art is. There are data constraints. There are constraints in terms of what our economic relationships. That's really what drives this whole thing, is the economic relationships that we've specified in this model, because we're looking at how changes in taxes will affect economic behavior. It, of course, will not replace policymakers. It's not going to spit out the best tax policy for you. You don't have to still have the honor of making that decision. And it won't replace your staff. In most specific tax proposals, and I think in terms of capital gains proposal the Senate will be looking at in a couple of weeks, the capital gains proposal clearly has some elements that need to be looked at outside OTIM. But OTIM can also add, I think, some valuable insight into how a capital gains reduction would affect the Oregon economy. It'll also, I think, you'll find that it'll give you a lot more information in terms of the trade-offs of a proposal. If you are a proponent of a proposal, it will probably tell you some things that will be very helpful in presenting your case. It'll also probably provide your opponents with some things that you'll be uncomfortable with, because it does show those trade-offs very clearly. I'm thinking that the additional information you have will allow you as decision makers to make more informed decisions, and that after all, is the goal. I put in this packet just as some tax system goals, and this is something that goes back to the orientation, and I put it in there because I always try to slip that reminder in about midway through the session. But if you look at these goals that we talked about in terms of what we want a tax system to do, number one is adequacy. I mean, there's no such thing as a good tax. It's there to provide revenue for you to provide services with. OTIM is really not going to help you much with that question. We do have some real crude efforts at trying to look at the links between expenditures and infrastructure and long-term economic growth. But frankly, the literature, there's not much about that, and most of those effects are pretty long-term. So I don't think it's going to give you a lot of information in that area. Where it will really help you is in the question of equity. It won't tell you whether a tax is fair or not, but it will tell you very clearly whether, after the shifting has taken place, whether it adds to progressivity or decreases progressivity in your tax system. So it'll give you a very clear sense of how that tax will affect the distribution of the tax burden in the system. And that's something we really haven't had before. I'll also show you economic efficiency, because those two are related. When we talk about feedback effects and dynamic effects, we're really talking about how the economy responds to the tax change. So, again, this is information we really haven't, we've been able to talk about, but haven't been able to quantify for you. So I think it's going to be very valuable. The last goal of administrative efficiency, we can have something that looks great in OTIM, but if the Department of Revenue can't administer it, it's not going to be a viable policy. So we still need to always keep that in mind when you look at various proposals. In terms of the page three there on the model itself, just a description and reminder for those who were not in the last session and involved in this. In this discussion, it was actually a pretty much a last-minute decision. The House Revenue Committee had passed out a bill for the creation of a tax incidence model. It kind of languished in Ways and Means until the final reconciliation there in the last week, and ended up getting put into Legislative Revenue Office budget, $300,000. We have used those dollars, not all of them, but a good deal of them. And basically what we did was establish a relationship with Oregon State, in which they have been our subcontractor. We have worked with Bruce Weber and also Dave Holland from Washington State, who was on sabbatical in Corvallis this past year. And we've committed a good deal of Ed's time and to this project. It was really, I would not have been willing to take it on, I think, in terms as an internal project without Ed's background, in which he's had a very extensive background in this kind of model building. We have two primary objectives, and those objectives are provide taxpayers and policymakers with information on the overall distribution of the tax burden, something we did not have before, and to develop the capacity to identify behavioral responses, the so-called dynamic response to tax changes. In terms of an approach to the project, a policy oversight a committee was established, and Representative Witt served as the chair of that committee. It had four members on it, and also four non-members. Gary Carlson, for example, was on it. Elizabeth Harachinko was on it. Olivia Clark. The decisions that were made by the model building team were that OTIM would be a general equilibrium model of the Oregon economy, and that we would link a distribution model to that. And that distribution model was developed really through the Department of Revenue linking property tax data with personal income tax data, and then tying that back to what we call a current population survey. And Bruce will go through the details of that, because that's a merging of a database that we had not been able to do before. It took a lot of effort on the part of the Department of Revenue. In terms of the output that you'll have, just to put what I see to be the major things that will come from this, you'll be able to determine who bears the ultimate burden. You'll move beyond the discussion that often comes up that what's the share of households versus the share of business. OTIM takes that a step further, because it through the interaction of economic markets, labor markets, and product markets, it shows who is actually affected by that tax. And that's what we mean by who bears the ultimate burden. You'll be able to assess long-term economic effects. This is a so-called equilibrium model. After all the changes have taken place, we've moved to a new equilibrium point. You'll be able to consider the revenue impacts, and you'll be able to incorporate this feedback effects. And I'll go through a proposal recommendation of how to do that and how it will affect your revenue impact statement. You'll be able to look at how tax proposals affect different income groups. I think it'll encourage you to take a longer-term view, because our model is essentially five years out. So you'll be able to see when we come to some new equilibrium, where are we going to be, and look at those effects a little bit further down the road. And most importantly, I think you're going to have more informed decisions about trade-offs. As I say, there's going to be some pluses and minuses in just about any proposal. I have the page four there has some key concepts there, and I won't go through those, but that's really kind of for you to refer back to on some of the terminology we use, and I know we get carried away with some of this. but what tax incidents mean, tax shifting, the CGE model we're working with, effective tax rate, we'll be referring to that a lot, and progress or regress and proportional, remember those are rate issues, rate measurements. Elasticity is another one we use quite frequently. It's showing how if we change something in the model, how does something else respond to that change. Results, just the again, these are the very much broad overview of the results. You can see on page 5 there, this is effective tax rates, which would be the personal income for this group, and we had talked about a good deal, and Representative Whittle will remember this, on the whether to incorporate capital gains or not in those incomes. And overwhelming feedback we got from our review groups was to include those capital gains. So we do have capital gains built into the income of those income groups, and those, of course, tend to be tilted toward the higher end. But if you look at the effective tax rate in Oregon, for most people in the Oregon economy, you think of middle income, for example, say 40 to 100,000, they're looking at about 11% of their income going to state and local taxes after all economic responses have been built in. So about and that rate is pretty flat. I don't have the federal rates in there. That's in your overall booklet. You'll see the federal system is a lot more progressive because of the income tax. Oregon's system is pretty flat, basically proportional. People are paying roughly the same percentage in taxes. By the way, most systems, most state systems, if we were to apply an OTIM type analysis, would be regressive because of the reliance on consumption tax. There is a regressive tail there. If you notice that 0 to 20,000 group there, that's our lowest income group, is 14,000 and below, are paying actually the highest effective rates after all shifting is built in. And the reason for that, you can see the big white bulge in there, is the property tax. And again, if you think back to the debate of the 80s and the policies of the 80s, it was the HARP, property tax relief, renter relief kind of programs are all aimed at that little bulge, and basically those programs have gone away. So and the bulge is very much there in terms of OTIM. A lot of that, it comes from two elements, OTIM shifting the business portion, which is the commercial and industrial part of the property tax, and the tax on particularly on low-income seniors because they have low current income, yet they tend to have their own homes. And the third element there is the renters. Pick up the other piece of that. The personal income tax is progressive throughout the income range and gives the system a little bit of a progressive tail there at the end for high-income groups because the personal income tax effective rate rises. It becomes kind of overpowers the property tax. Now that's for the current system. So we'll be looking at any changes, tax proposals in comparison to the current system. The feedback effects, what we've done to get feedback effects, and I've given you examples here. We've imposed what economists call a shock to the model, and the shock is either a $100 million annual personal income tax increase or a comparably sized corporate income tax increase or a business excise tax, which would be like a gross receipts tax, or a business property tax, which is that commercial and industrial component of the property tax. So now if you were asked, if you presented a bill that did this in terms of our current analysis and we came through and we estimated without any economic effects, $100 million, which is what we've done in each of these, we would then take it and put it in to OTIM, run it through to look at the economic effects. Well, for any tax increase, the economic effects are negative because what we're doing, we're taking resources out of the economy, we're reducing the return on in terms of labor, in terms of capital, or we're increasing prices for consumers, and therefore they reduce their spending. So the feedback effects of a tax increase are going to be negative. And we have estimated what those feedback effects are for each of those types of taxes, and they vary quite a bit. In terms of the corporate income tax, we see the largest feedback effects. So instead of a $100 million increase in revenue, we would have about an $83 million increase. Keep in mind, this is after all changes have taken place. So this is about 5 years down the road. We're not saying this is going to take place in the first year. So corporate shows the biggest feedback effects. The smallest tends to come from the personal income tax. Basically, because people don't do much different with an increase in personal income tax. They pretty much do the same thing that they do before the tax. So it has a smaller feedback effect. Corporate is a lot more sensitive because it's based on the return, the net return to capital, which is what economists consider highly elastic. Okay, so you know, that seems, it seems pretty clear that the corporate would have the biggest feedback effect. But it, if you look at the economic numbers here, and all of these are would be applied in terms of the current forecast. But if we were to look at it, most of them are negative. You'd have a decrease in personal income from what it would have been, a decrease in the return to capital, decrease in employment. The personal income tax is interesting because even though it has the smallest feedback effects, number one, it actually has a positive wage effect because workers actually have more capital to work with under this scenario. And it also has the biggest employment effect. So even though it has the smallest revenue feedback effect, it has the biggest job effect. Well, it's interesting when you can look through those kinds of nuances and how different proposals may affect the economy. Also notice that the business portion of the property tax, although it's pretty close to the excise tax, has the biggest effect on consumer prices. No, a $100 million increase there is going to increase our consumer price index by almost a tenth of a percent in the case of the business property tax. Remember, $100 million is not big in terms of the overall economy, but it would be big in terms of revenue. So those are the, gives you a sense of what the, these are very generic kinds of proposals. What we'll have to do is we'll have to work through and as much as we can build in the details of a specific proposal, because when you start looking at individual bills, there's always some differences. The distribution effects are on the next page, page 7. This shows you how each of these shocks would affect the distribution of the tax burden. There's the income groups we're using, starting with less than $14,000 for the lowest group, and above $126,000 for the highest.
Well, are we still on the same simulation, $100,000, as we were on the previous table?
Yes, we are.
Table?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right.
$100 million, rather.
$100 million for each of these. Mm-hmm. So this is the same shock. So what we're, we'll produce will be a revenue impact with the feedback effects, the economic effects, and then the distribution effects. All of that will be part of the impact statement. If you look at the first column there in share of total household income, that's what that previous baseline chart was. That's how that effective rate varies in terms of, or the, excuse me, that's the share of income each of those households has. Now, you can compare that then with that share of the total tax change. If the share of the total tax change is less, then the burden for that group has declined relatively. If it's more, then it's increased relatively. So for the case of a personal income tax change, the share of the total tax change is lower for the 14,000 and less group than their share of income is. So therefore, it's adding progressivity to the system. You're increasing taxes, but you're making the system more progressive because the highest group is picking up 25% of that tax change, whereas they've got 22% of the income. Okay, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then you notice that if you look at the business taxes that tend to affect consumer prices, notice that they have a much bigger effect on the lower income groups because they're picking up over 4% of the total tax change, yet they're less than 3% of the income. to those proposals that actually add or reduce progressivity.
Remember, progressivity, it doesn't mean it's good or bad. It's just telling you what those distribution effects are. And you could weigh that against other things, other goals that you have.
So, again, this will be, you'll be able to look at those economic effects and then look and see how does this shift around who shares the, how the burden, tax burden is distributed. My last page, and this would be the basis, really, for discussion on the recommended committee rule change. When to use? Well, the recommendation here is from the Tax Incidence Oversight Committee, and basically they recommended that it be used in those cases where there is an initial or static estimate of $10 million for the biennium, that pretty much be a standard. But they also recommended that the House and Senate Revenue Committee chairs basically have the final discretion. There may be times when greater than $10 million, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I'm thinking in terms of the cigarette surcharge, for example, the sunset on that. Does that make sense? Well, that's a pretty narrow, you're dealing with one particular market there.
And OTIM's probably not going to help much in terms of that analysis. But also, there may be cases when the House and Senate committee chairs feel a particular proposal where there would be some better information here that may be useful for the committee. So basically, to lay that out is at the discretion.
The other thing, though, to keep in mind about OTIM, number one, sometimes it's not going to help you much. It may muddy the water if it's a very specific kind of proposal. And two, we don't want to kill off Ed in the process, so.
With too many proposals. Yeah. So, as I say, most, you know, if you're really looking at a serious piece of legislation, there's going to be a lot of nuances in it that are going to have to be modeled in a specific way. So it's not just pushing a button. The revenue impact statements, the changes that will take place here when OTIM is used, first of all, it'll be tied to the revenue forecast as it is now. That's not any different, but to make sure that this is in no way a replacement for the state's econometric model. This is not a forecasting model. It's something that would show a change, everything else the same, and we can embed it into the forecast changes. Impacts should cover three biennium because we're looking at really a five-year period. Each impact will show the initial or static revenue impact, the estimated feedback effects like we showed on those on the chart, and then what the combination would be. So you have a $100 million increase, feedback would be minus $10 million, net of 90. Keep in mind when we say feedback of 10% or 17% in the case of corporate, we're talking about all
governments, not just the general fund, about state and local governments, because
OTIM produces those results. Full feedback effects are assumed to take 5 years. We think that's a reasonable assumption. It's the assumption made by the California Department of Finance and the DRAM model that this is patterned after in many ways. But sometimes you could argue that it should be faster, sometimes slower. But you think that 5 years is a reasonable proxy for most tax changes. The impact statement should show those economic stats we looked at, summary kind of stats on jobs and income, and then also show that distribution of the tax burden. So you'll be able to look at that and see, well, how does this affect how things are currently distributed. Finally, in terms of the limitations, there are areas where our data, frankly, is not real good at the state level. We actually do not have nearly as good a data as Canada does at the provincial level. We haven't invested as much money into it, and it's kind of ironic that as our computing power increases, our data seems to be getting worse. But we do have, as I say, I think the best data available for the states. Economic relationships are the key to this. Some economic relationships, we've got very extensive empirical evidence, and we've gone to the literature and used that. Other areas, it's pretty sparse. So, you know, that's, OTIM is something that is not going to be put on the shelf and kept the same. It's going to have to be refined and developed over time and improved as more information is available. Timing of the effects, some of that is clearly in a rudimentary stage. We don't know the actions of other states. One of the issues that you'll be looking at is the apportionment formula for corporate income. Well, we'll be able to look at that with OTIM, but you know, the ultimate effect of that change, a lot of that is going to be influenced by the decisions of other states, particularly California, which we don't have a model of California here. We have a model of Oregon. Now, the other issue is levels of aggregation. We have to aggregate in all economic models so that we've got, you know, pretty widely grouped industry groups, widely grouped income distribution groups. At a higher level of aggregation, then sometimes might give you the best insights. But that's just a limitation, a data limitation, and just a computing limitation for us. So those are the kind of a summary of where we are with this, again, I think it's going to be something that will add something important to your toolbox to look at proposals. It's not going to be a panacea by any means, but I think we're clearly ahead of where we've been in the past.
Questions for Paul? I'm excited. I think it's... Well, tell me, how long does it take? I mean, is that it right there? Is that OTIM?
And no, Mr. Chair, that's not the real OTIM. We keep that behind us.
How long? Maybe Ed, are you the one to answer that?
We get a bill, and it's to raise taxes $100 million or cut taxes $100 million.
What kind of inputting is there, and how long does it take to develop the kind of material that we're looking at here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ed Waters, Legislative Revenue Office. The answer is, of course, that depends.
Any other questions? What are the variables?
If it's a broad-based proportional rate change, like the scenarios we've run, then it's pretty straightforward. But if it's, like most things, tailored to specific industries or actors, then it will take more time and more finesse. As far as the model itself, actually, it is on this computer, too. It's pretty small, just a few hundred lines of code, and it'll solve in less than a minute. So the real art is in how long it takes you to set things up.
Getting the data to put in.
That's correct. Yeah.
Well,
can I explore that a little further?
Sure.
When we looked at this in terms of sort of broad application, so let's say... Mr. Bieberle comes in here and asks us for a real estate transfer tax. I'm trying to get Jerry.
Oh, Mr. Bieberle, huh?
Mr. Bieberle, oh. Yeah. If Jerry Bieberle came in here and asked us for a real estate transfer tax for...
I did that 4 years ago, guys.
Okay. How would...
That was the elastic effect.
So that's a very specific... That's a specific change. That's not reflect. I mean, we don't have a column for real estate transfer tax. Where does that fit in the model? So I guess what you do then, someone would do an estimate that would say that will cost $300 or $50 million a year to somebody. Then you would then take that $50 million and run it in this model, or would you have to put it into a certain category or field in the model?
Representative Beck, members of the committee, yes. Basically, we would have to translate that into terms that the model can handle, plug it into the right field, say, and then turn the crank. I don't think that kind of proposal would be that difficult. Again, famous last words. I should know better than to say things like that.
I guess I'm still... maybe you just need to sit for a while. It'll sort itself.
Representative Witt, as chair, did you want to say anything before we move on? I want to thank and congratulate you for.
Well, I had really not a whole lot to do with it, Mr. Chairman. I do think this is would be a wonderful tool for the legislature, both from the standpoint of better analyzing proposed tax changes to understand what the ultimate and actual effect of those proposals are relative to revenues, but also from the standpoint of distribution, because I think often people are shocked to see how our system as it is today unduly burdens low-income Oregonians, and I think it gives us the opportunity to look at various tax changes and how they flow through the system and how it impacts different groups of Oregonians. It'll allow us to adopt tax policy that's, I guess, more just in terms of how it impacts different sectors of our population. So I think this is a be a real wonderful tool, and it's a tremendous asset. It's really a it's a tribute to Ed and Bruce and others that worked on this project, because they spent an awful lot of time during the interim to get this done, and it's no easy task. But we have something here that very few states have, and I think will be a real aid for legislators who use it effectively.
Well, oh yeah.
Once we have the data entered, say hypothetically speaking, it's say a revenue chairman has a hypothetical business activities tax.
That's right.
We can have you, once it's in, sit there and with your laptop and say, what if we went from 13% to 12.5%? And you can plug that in.
You're way too high. But
wrong, wrong.
Say, what if we went from 2.5 to 15%?
Representative Haas, members of the committee, once it's configured properly, marginal changes shouldn't be too difficult. But keep in mind that huge changes sometimes blow the thing out of its comfortable solution space, and they require additional configuration to get response that stands the last test.
We'll find out.
But I guess you have to have a separate field for each type of tax that's out there. Do you have a column for, some kind of business activity tax or real estate transfer tax or business energy tax credit that I think is coming? We've got four columns here on our handout, four types of taxes. Is there a list a mile long of each type of conceivable tax that's out there?
Representative Banks, look on page 34 in your book.
Mm-hmm.
We also have federal government taxes, too. Mm-hmm. It's on page 33. But 34 and then on to the next page shows you state taxes and then state expenditures and how they're broken out. And then even on the following page shows you all the local revenues.
So these are fields that are already in the model, and then if that's the right term, field.
The model is much, it's much more detailed for the public sector than it is for private, for obvious reasons, it's so we can look at these policy issues.
But there are probably a handful of taxes we don't have in Oregon that will just allow us to look at taxes we don't have experience with, and so that's... But there aren't fields for those in the model, or are there?
We just have to apply them to the appropriate base. So if the field is, if the base is retail sales, you apply it to that.
Okay.
Ed, why don't you go ahead? Jonas, you bring the lights down.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's maybe not necessary, I think. Well, we'll see. I tried to make this high contrast. So I'll be working from packets that starts like this, and I'll be giving you a
television audience.
I'll be backing up a little bit and giving you the description of the model, and then working into some sensitivity analysis that we did to test some of our assumptions. But basically, OTIM is a so-called computable general equilibrium model. Emphasis on computable, so it'll fit on a computer and you can turn a crank and get it to solve. It's multi-sectoral. You have a number of industries, a number of government-type sectors, a number of households, etc. So it adds a lot of complexity. It is, as Paul mentioned, designed to calculate adjustments to economic shocks. And you would apply those relative to a economic baseline that you'd get from another source, like a forecasting model. The way it works is that it always has to have income equal to expenditures in all accounts at solution. So households' expenditures have to equal their amount of income, government expenditures have to equal their amount of revenue, et cetera. And for businesses, that constraint is applied by supply equals to demand, which is, in economic terms, the same thing as income equal to expenditures. The variables that produce the solution are relative prices. They adjust until supply equals demand, income equals expenditures in all accounts simultaneously. And as Paul mentioned, it's, we're looking at really a five-year adjustment period. So input, the change, press the button, hits out a counterfactual scenario, which we think of as 5 years down the road. This is what things will look like. The core of a CG model is really the circular flow of income. And it's very simple. This is the simplest model of it, I think. You've got firms and households. Firms are supplying goods and services to households to fill households' demand. Households are paying for these, paying revenue to the firms in return for these goods and services. Firms hire or demand labor and capital services from households in order to produce these goods and services. So it forms a nice tight little loop. And we can rapidly blow that tight little loop into a lot of complexity. Really all we've done here is we still have the circular flow diagram from before in the center of these loops. But now we've got foreign firms and foreign households interacting with the local economy. We have firms not only buying or hiring labor and capital from households, but they're also purchasing inputs from other firms in the region and also from foreign firms. We have government now in this model, so economic actors, households, firms are paying taxes. So these different government entities, different taxes on different bases coming out at different points in the economic cycle. And in return, government would be supplying some services to firms and households, although we're getting beyond the ability of a diagram like this to handle that level of complexity, so that piece isn't shown. Now, how do we structure this so that we can model this in a CG type model? Well, what we do is we put it into a nice square matrix we call a social accounting matrix, or SAM, and it is a circular flow diagram for a CG type model. It's a, as I mentioned, a square matrix, so the number of rows is equal to the number of columns. Each cell represents an economic transaction between two types of agents. This is considerably aggregated compared to what is in the OTIM model. For example, this first column, it shows that there are 29 industries, so and two factors, and eight households, and 58 state and local government sectors. So if we're going to expand this to show what it looks like for OTIM, it would be 110 columns by 110 rows, basically, to get the whole picture. If you go across a row, you can see, if you go across the industry row, you can see the component of demand for industries, goods, and services. We have industries purchasing inputs from other industries, households satisfying consumer demand, government purchasing from goods and services industries produce. We've got trade. We've got goods and services exported to buyers outside of the region. You have an investment. Industries are buying goods and services from other industries for investment goods or investment purposes, et cetera. This next slide isn't really meant to be funny, but it gives you an idea of what the...
It's not meant to be funny?
No, it's not.
Well, you succeeded.
But I wanted to show you what some of the... This is fairly comprehensive. It's almost all of the economic accounts in the model. Representative Beck asked a moment ago what kinds of tax or revenue items are in the model. Well, I've got them listed here, and this is pretty complete. A state government list here, starting with tobacco tax and going down to a miscellaneous type of account, about 29 state government revenue accounts. Local government revenue, there are about 22 local government revenue accounts, including local government fuel taxes and ending with charges for community college, tuition and whatnot. We've got some government expenditure accounts. The government expenditures aren't as detailed as the government revenue accounts are. We have basically three expenditure accounts for state government, three expenditure accounts for local government, and one expenditure account for federal government, or the activity that the federal government extends in the state. On the left side shows the list of aggregated industry sectors in the model. There are 29 of them. There are 8 household income categories, as Paul mentioned and showed you in a slide a little while ago. The last item I was going to cover had to do with the testing of our model to see how sensitive it was to some of the multitude of assumptions we had to build into it to make it work. What we're showing here is a table that compares the baseline calibration of OTIM, that's the center column here, with scenarios where we've changed some of the elasticity assumptions by reducing them by 50% in this left-hand column and increasing the baseline parameter assumptions by 50% in this right-hand column. I'm focusing on the corporate income tax change for this particular illustration. We could have used one of the other ones, but this one shows some nice sensitivity effects, I think. So what we've done, we've changed some of these model parameters, sort of one set at a time, run the model, and observed what the revenue feedback effect is, compare that with what it is in the baseline model. As Paul mentioned, in the OTIM baseline, the feedback effect for the corporate income tax shock, this is, again, $100 million static increase in corporate income taxes. The feedback effect is about 17%, which means that instead of raising $100 million, you would get about $83 million total in total state and local revenues after the behavioral adjustment and feedback effects had worked their way through the model. Generally, a higher elasticity implies more sensitivity in the model, more behavioral response on the part of economic agents, and generally leads to greater dynamic feedback effects over the 5-year adjustment period in the model. For example, the trade elasticities, these are the parameters which govern the price sensitivity of goods and services in the economy, particularly with respect to imports and exports. Oregon is a so-called small economy, a very open economy. Imports supply about almost half of our total demand in the state. Exports also comprise about 50% of our total industry production in the state. So you can see that when we reduce the trade elasticities as a set by 50%, we change the revenue feedback quite a bit. It goes from the 17%, you can think of that as $17 million change from the $100 million static, that goes down to a 5.4%. feedback. So instead of netting $83 million, you would net now about $95 million. So there's less ability to adjust and less behavioral adjustments going on in the model. And so there's less of a total feedback, revenue feedback effect going on, less adjustment in the other economic variables as well. The opposite happens when you increase the values on those parameters, and you go up to almost 22% revenue feedback for the trade elasticity experiment. So you're getting even more feedback, you're getting more price responsiveness, and that's causing greater behavioral changes in the economy. Beyond the trade elasticity set, the next biggest impact from changing the assumptions goes to the migration elasticity parameters. This is a set of parameters that govern the responsiveness of households who enter and leave the state. And there's a table in your packet, in your booklet, that shows that. Migration is a function of after-tax income of households, unemployment level in the state, and also related to spending on education by state and local governments. So there is some responsiveness to changes in those elasticities, but not on the scale that we see with the for the trade elasticity. The next most sensitive parameter are the investment elasticities, and finally the labor supply. Investment refers to the change in desired capital stock level for a change in the returns to capital. Labor supply refers to the change in the labor force in response to real wages, or change in real wages, changes in personal income tax, and also the lowest income group has responsiveness to change in transfer payments as well in the OTIM. The one that looks probably most out of step, if you stare at this long enough, is this public infrastructure variable and the response to that. This is a variable which transmits or feeds back some of the impact of change in government spending back to the cost functions or supply functions of firms, private firms in the economy. The idea here is to try and capture some of the infrastructure effect that government spending has on the private economy. Probably the most often cited example of this is road building or road maintenance. Increased expenditures in this area tend to improve the economic environment and reduce costs for suppliers and shippers in the local economy. What we have going on here is as you increase the public infrastructure elasticity, you actually reduce the feedback effects a little bit. The interpretation here is that the higher elasticity allows a relatively more benefit to producers from any increase in government spending associated with the tax increase. And this reduces the private economy's negative response to the tax increase. So that's what's going on here. Again, the main point to take away from this is that we're very sensitive to the trade elasticity assumptions. Trade elasticities in this range, if we take the OTIM base set and take half of that, those values, that puts us into the so-called inelastic price response range, which for an economy like Oregon, an open, small open economy like Oregon, is probably not representative. It's probably not a very good assumption. We're much more likely to be closer to what we've incorporated in the baseline, or possibly even the higher elasticity set for the trade parameters.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Anybody brave enough to ask a question?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, okay.
On this, it's intriguing on this infrastructure one in relationship to, I hate to admit it, but I agree with you, and at the risk of sounding like a geek, this is kind of exciting. But,
thanks, I
didn't quite come out.
Essence
bill. You could look at the cost of increasing, for example, gasoline tax, and what it would do then by raising $800 million or whatever it was as a benefit to the economy versus the offset cost.
Representative House, members of the committee, that's correct. This public infrastructure variable is intended to get at some of those positive feedbacks that we associate with certain kinds of spending, government spending, anyway. So that increase in tax is not unambiguously a negative impact on the private economy. There is some, albeit limited, positive feedback coming from the expenditure, judicious expenditure of the money by the government.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yeah. If I could add something here on the, you know, these are the really the key to the model, these response functions, and, you know, the parameters we plugged in there, and I think Ed's been pretty straightforward about some areas. There are some data constraints, certainly. But, you know, we were fortunate to have the California DRAM model to use. They've did a thorough search of the literature and also bounce ideas off them. And, you know, we've got their code and their model up and running in our office as well. And also, I point out that if you look through the details of our work group, Lori Brown from Washington Department of Revenue Research was also in our work group, and Washington is constructing a similar general equilibrium model. So we've been in regular contact with our West Coast partners here on these types of models, and I expect that to continue over the years as we hone in on these and get a better sense of what the most realistic assumptions are.
Okay. Joan, can we bring the lights up again, please? And Bruce, I guess that takes us to you.
It does. My name is, for the record, my name is Bruce Weber from Oregon State University, Representative Shetterly, members of the committee. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk about this distributional part of the model. Ed has just talked about the feedback effects of the OTIM model. What I'd like to do is describe the work that went into the distributional baseline. Now, you need a distributional baseline in order to know whether any change that you make makes the system more proportional or less proportional, or more progressive or less progressive, because you need to know how progressive the system is right now. And that's what this baseline does. It tells you how the burden of taxes, both direct taxes and shifted business taxes, are distributed among different income groups. I'd like to focus on really four things in my remarks for the next 15 minutes. The first is generally, how are households distributed among these eight income groups? In this model, there are eight income groups that we, in order to make the distributional part consistent with the dynamic part, we were constrained to eight different income groups, the ones that are listed in the table, which the lowest group starts at or goes up to 14,000. The first table on your handout, and I'm looking at a handout that you have that looks like this, a lot of typing at one table in the middle, shows how the households in this state, and households are the unit we use for analysis. Households are anybody living together in a single housing unit. It's different than a family, but these housing units share certain costs, and we figured that it was best to use the housing unit as the unit of analysis. What this table tells you about, it tells you how many housing units are in each of these eight income groups. It also tells you how much income is in each of these eight income groups. For example, if you look at the table, the lowest income group, which has 16% of the households, has 3% of the income. And the highest income group, which has 5% of the households, has 24% of the income. That's the information that's in the first table. Now, in order to know how a tax change that affects an income group will affect people in the economy, we put together a graphic, which is also in your packet, which shows what household types are in each income group. And Ed, if you could put up the... Oops. Sorry.
Sorry, no, that's fine. Let's bring it back down.
There is a poster that I'm not sure whether you'll be able to see the poster better or the computer better. People here will be able to see the computer better. I'd like to just walk through this poster a little bit because this really tells you what household types are in each of the eight income groups. There are six different household types. Single households, which is this purple group off to the left. Couple households, which is the light blue. Single households with dependents, which is the dark blue here. Couple households with dependents, which is this medium blue here. And then two sets of households that are multi-generational, which is the large group here, and roommate-only households, which are groups of unrelated individuals living together.
I'm sorry, Bruce, one question. On the left side, you've got single blue ones and single green ones. What's the difference there?
Okay, single green ones. Green icons indicate people who are over 65 years of age and not working. And they're both, of course, in couples or single or married to people who are under 65 and working. This shows the various combinations of everybody who's not green on this chart is under age 65, and the over 65 and not working are indicated in green. Now, what's very clear from this chart, there are a couple of things that are quite clear from this chart. First is that people who are over 65 and not working, single people who are over 65 and not working, are disproportionately represented in the lowest income class, as are single parents with dependents, which is this dark blue group here. You don't see many single parents with dependents up at the top. You see most of the single parents with dependents at the bottom. You see a lot of single adults that are over 65 and not working at the lower ends as well. Couple households and couple households with dependents are not unexpectedly tend to be in the middle and the upper income classes. I guess we thought it would be interesting for you to have this as a reference, so as you look at the distribution of taxes among different households, you'd have a sense of who it is in each of these groups that's being affected by the tax change. And could ask yourself, are these the groups that I want to either have pay higher taxes or pay lower taxes? There is a second chart which I'm not going to go through, which is a little more complex, which is a workforce chart. Same icons basically as this, but
more colorful.
They're colored to show whether they're high income or low income occupations. This story there is a little more difficult to synthesize, but that again will show you who it is that's in the various income groups. These income groups along the side here are proportional to the income ranges. That is, this bottom group, the income range is 14,000. It's about the same range as in the next two income groups, and we had to do that because of getting to OTIM. Of course, the way income is distributed, there are a lot of people who make more than 126,000, and in order to capture that group, we've put them in a separate little inset here at the end. Someone who made $500,000, for example, would be about 9 feet higher than the top of that chart. So it wasn't possible to get all of those icons in any kind of a reasonable scale. But the bottom 95% of the income distribution is represented in scale on this chart.
Let's see. Maybe I'll just flip from here.
This is who's affected by this, or who's affected by tax changes, who's in each of these eight income groups in OTIM. The next thing I'd like to just briefly go over is the process for establishing the tax burden. The tax burden in this model is direct household taxes, that is corporate, or that is personal income tax, household property taxes, and taxes on consumer purchases such as cigarettes and liquor. It's those taxes which are assigned directly to households. And it's business taxes that are shifted to households. A business tax is corporate income tax, the business property tax, certain excise taxes, employer rate mile and fuel taxes that are paid by businesses but shifted to households. And we've shifted these taxes to households in two steps. First, we have an estimate of how much of these taxes are paid by out-of-staters, how much is exported out-of-state, either through capital returns that lower capital returns in other states or wages of people who work in Oregon and live elsewhere. And so the first step is really to figure out how much of this tax doesn't fall on Oregonians but falls on other people. And the average for Oregon business taxes is about 18%, as best we can figure. So 18% of the Oregon business taxes are shifted to out-of-state taxpayers. The remaining 82% then is distributed among Oregon households, among these eight income classes, using the information out of OTIM about the response that Oregon taxpayers and Oregon workers and Oregon businesses have to a tax change. So we use the information that's in the model to distribute these taxes in the baseline. This is something which is not ordinarily done. Ordinarily, you make certain assumptions and you arbitrarily sort out taxes to consumers or people who own capital. We've used economic information about how people respond and built that into our process for allocating the remaining business taxes among these eight household types. What we end up with then is a table that shows how all taxes, household taxes and business taxes, are allocated among these eight income classes. And Ed, this is where I'm going to need the next chart, which you had up before and now isn't here. We'll have to shift here. But this next, it's on page two of your handout. It shows how household and business taxes are distributed among the eight income classes, and then what the effective tax rate is for each of these income classes, what Paul showed you in his presentation. And this is the way we get to that chart. We estimate how many or how much household tax each class pays directly, and then shift it, as I described earlier, we shift the business taxes to each income class using information in OTIM. And when we do that, we get a distribution which looks like the graph that Paul showed you earlier and is also reproduced here, which shows a basically proportional structure except at the lower end where there's a little hook at the bottom for the very lowest income class. I guess this would be a point at which either Ed or I could entertain additional questions, either about the distributional part of this model or about the dynamic feedback part.
Questions?
Or anything else you want to ask, I guess.
So, Chair?
Yeah.
Take a crack at it here. So you have, I think I understood you're saying that you have factored in people's behavior, consumptive behavior. We have a sense of what each of these groups of people are, how they behave when a price goes up.
Yes, exactly.
That's in here.
Yes.
So, and we have a sense in the model of how much a business passes a new cost onto people, and then how people respond to that. That's in the model.
That's what the model tells us, is by, if the tax goes up, how much ultimately will be shifted to consumers in terms of higher prices or back to factor suppliers, owners of capital, workers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the information or the assumptions, the economic we use economic theory and empirical economic studies to get information about how people respond and then build that into the model. And then the model tells us, if you change this price, how will it be shifted?
Well, I guess that's, I mean, there's often, I often hear people say, if we increase this tax, the price will go up.
Right.
And that just doesn't, I mean, the home builders say this, the bottlers say it, everyone says it, and we'll just pass it off to consumers. Well, consumers are only going to pay a certain amount, right? So
sure.
There may be some changes, but it may be reflected in less profits or capital for the business to invest.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
Ed, do you want to kind of jump in here?
Well, and I suppose different taxes are going to result in different
outcomes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And different products have different responses, different elasticity.
Right.
If consumers have some substitutes available of untaxed products, if they're available from Washington or something, then they're going to be very responsive.
Right.
When businesses try to pass on that tax. If they're stuck with some local service, then they're going to be less likely to respond. They don't have other choices.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I'd point out, to follow up on Representative Beck's question, by increasing the tax on a product, you will likely lessen demand for the product. In addition to consumers paying a higher price and or shareholders getting less of a return or employees getting lower wages, you probably also end up with less demand and less production of that product.
Depending on the
I think virtually any product, is with the exception of maybe air and water.
Parking garages?
Oh, absolutely. If you raise the tax on parking garages, people will find some other way to either get there or to put their car somewhere else. Because you raise the cost of the product. Raising the cost of the product will lessen the demand. It's different, of course, depending upon the product. You know, like air, you know, you're gonna whatever cost you're gonna get the air pretty much.
But
water.
Is that also though the part of the 5-year thing? Because you're going to have that kind of incidence is going to be more noticeable at the front end, isn't it, of a tax effect, and doesn't that tend to get absorbed into behavior years out?
If I can respond, it depends how quickly the consumer can respond to an alternative. In some products, you have an alternative right away. In other situations, the market may have to develop for an alternative.
But these are all things that OTIM at least can give us some information on, I guess. I don't want to say tell us, because we'll ultimately have to figure out what it's telling us, but it can give us information on these kind of effects.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Witt's points are very well taken. Ultimately, the tax burden, the incidence, depends on the supply and demand
mm-hmm.
and the relative responsiveness of each of those.
Bruce, you mentioned, I want to get back to you, you said something about we export 18%, is that it, of the tax burden?
Right.
And OTIM, if that's under the current system, OTIM can give us, will OTIM reflect adjustments in that for different taxes, or is that one of the givens in OTIM?
With OTIM, Representative Shedley, it's very difficult to figure out ultimately how much of any tax gets exported. What we've got here in this 17.8% is really information that's in OTIM about how much of each product is currently exported and how much the taxes are on each of those. So for each industry, we know how much excise, how much business tax they pay, and we know how much they export. And this 17.8% is really just the product of those two pieces of information. So for a static analysis, pretty comfortable with the notion that 18% is exported. In a dynamic analysis, I'm not sure we'll be able to finally determine how much of any of the tax is actually exported. That's my sense, anyway.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, that's partly true. I think the
well, that's very, very nice.
I think we can estimate what the change in that ratio will be after a tax change, but we can't say now, for example, that if you increased every tax in the Oregon state and local system by X amount, at the end of that, still 17% of those taxes would be exported. Because generally, we're a small economy, Oregon is a small economy, if our costs go up, we're not very well able to pass on those costs to buyers outside of the state. There are lots of strong competitors who can supply goods and services to markets outside of our state and keep our costs, make it so we have to keep our costs low as well.
Any other questions? Paul, anything more for us?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If I could interrupt real quick, just going to ask, do we have any proposals that will be coming before the committee in the relatively near future that we're going to actually, I may have missed your discussion of this early out today, but do we have any proposals coming forward where we're going to actually take this thing out for a spin and see what she'll do?
Okay.
Yeah? Interruption of wage, I think House Bill 3942 would be a good one.
Which is?
That's the business activities tax.
I guess that raises a question. Would this, in order to get some familiarity with this model, would it be better to start with something macro like that, or a couple of smaller things like the
beer tax,
like the beer? Well, yeah, it's a good one. And the single, what do they call it? Single sales. I mean, I guess that's up to you, Paul. What's going to help us best? What kind of tax would be best for us to really grapple with this thing, macro or micro?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind OTEM's level of aggregation. I mean, it is still kind of a big picture model.
Mm-hmm.
And as I put in the summary, it's not real good at something that's very industry specific, and because you've got so many nuances within that industry. OTEM is really looking at the broad interaction of economic actors. So I do think something like a broad consumption tax would be a good thing to look at.
Illustrate. Right.
It's always risky when you don't have a tax and then you impose a large version of one, because you are making a large change and you might get outside those what the parameters have really been tested for. But really, I think that's where OTM is going to be most useful, is in those kind of broad-based proposals. And, I would see some of the other issues that you're going to have before you, the apportionment formula, the capital gains.
Sure.
Those are going to require certainly some work to tailor it, but they would be ones that are broad enough and affect enough sectors in the economy. OTM will give you some
input. Would you say those would be more appropriate to OTM than one of our bills from this week, tax credits for post-secondary scholarships or something like that?
I think so.
Too narrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there you've got the key parameter on those credits is how do people respond to the credit itself? Does that change their giving patterns? And that's a very precise kind of response. Well, the secondary effects we can pick up pretty well, but that initial effect, Ed, you might want to comment on that. I think that would be a tough one for OTEM to deal with. You'd be looking at that initial effect outside the model and then tagging it in.
The gleaners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Paul said it well. Some of those narrowly targeted tax vehicles would be hard to model very well in OTIM, I think.
Mr. Chair, if I could,
yes.
Just one more question. What, for example, if we use the single sales factor as an example, if we wanted to get the OTIM analysis on that, what kind of a again, I apologize for missing this. Is it a fairly laborious effort to get that out of the system, or is this one of those things sort of like calling down and asking for a runoff of school district funding?
Which we know is easy.
Yeah.
You just got to... You just... Yeah, there's Steve. Yeah. Steve gets the joke, doesn't he?
You know, I think that it's... if you're able to have something that, you know, the ultimate simple tax change is the kicker. Because that's you know, proportional across the board, we could do that pretty quick and turn it around. But when you get into some real specifics about a specific bill where you've got some nuances in it, then we're looking at, you know, giving Ed at least a couple of days to work through that.
Okay. That's actually better than I thought I was going to hear.
But, you know, it depends on the complexity of the proposal. So, you know, I think there needs to be some prioritization. We do have an amended committee rule.
Yeah, let's get on to that, and I think we're about ready to wrap up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I propose that we adopt the proposed additional rule number 15 relative to the Oregon Tax Incentives Model.
Committee, that's on page 3, and this is the rule that does come to us from the work group, which Paul referred to earlier in the discussion. Is there any discussion of the rule, of the motion? Any objection? I think we'll just take this by objection. If there's any objection, we'll note it. Otherwise, we'll call it unanimous. Vote in favor of adoption of the rule. No objection. That's the word. All right. Thank you, Ed and Bruce and Paul. I'm excited to have this in the garage, and I can't wait to take it out for a spin. Representative Senator Beyer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. And we are adjourned. Have a good weekend.